I think what we'll do is save questions until all of our speakers have spoken. And then at the end, anybody who wants to direct a question to a particular speaker can just say so, and we'll go on from there. The heart of City Journal is its group of extraordinary writers. A lot of journalists have theories or sometimes just attitudes about the world, and they're all too ready to fit the facts into their theory without examining them too closely. Even if you happen to share their ideology, this makes for pretty boring journalism. City Journal writers, by contrast, are almost obsessively curious about the real world and all its contradictoriness. They like to know how it actually works. They have a rich store of observation and experience, and they've thought hard to make sense of it. They don't set much store by postmodern talk about relativism and perspectives. They have an old-fashioned confidence that there's such a thing as truth, and they try to find it out and tell it. Contributing editor Peter Reinhartz, our next speaker, is a case in point. The first of two tough prosecutors you will hear today. He has experience to spare. When he writes, as he has done in City Journal, about juvenile justice or about how New York's highest court far outdoes the Warren Court in finding ways to set convicted felons free, he does so from inside as New York's chief juvenile crime prosecutor. He knows from up close how kids go wrong and why and what they themselves think about it. He knows in detail the realities of life in the underclass from seeing its casualties every day. Not only a prosecutor and a City Journal writer, he's also an adjunct professor at Fordham Law and author of the recent book, Killer Kids, Bad Law. Peter Reinhartz.
I can't rap, but don't leave. Unless you've been living on another planet for the last few years, you have to know that there's been something that they've asked me to talk about, a crime turnaround. Certainly New York's crime turnaround has probably driven the crime turnaround for the rest of the city. And most of you who are New Yorkers, for the rest of the nation, for most of you as New Yorkers, you've probably seen it in your neighborhoods, but you've seen it as an observer. I, as a New Yorker, have seen it as a citizen, but also I've seen it from the inside. And I'd like to tell you really when the turnaround began. It was late January or early February of 1994, and I got called to a meeting down at Police Plaza. There was a new administration in, there was a new police department in, at least the heads of the police department. There was, nobody heard of Comstat didn't even exist yet, and we got called down because there was a meeting on narcotics. They were going to put together a new narcotics initiative. And it was run by a deputy commissioner, Jack Maple, was the deputy commissioner running the meeting, and he had all the city people there. He had a lot of the DAs, people from the AG's office, and a lot of other people from the criminal justice community. And we're all sitting around this very big table, and there's other people sitting on the side because there wasn't enough room. And the commissioner starts talking about bringing back something like TNT. Those of you may remember TNT, tactical narcotics teams. They basically go into neighborhood, they do sweeps. It's a buy and bust. They send in undercover officers, then the backup team goes in and they arrest everybody involved in the drug trade, cleans up the neighborhoods. And everybody's sort of, the prosecutors were all sitting there, yeah, this is a good idea, we've been waiting for this. The special narcotics prosecutor's got an ear-to-ear grin. And there's one set at the table, the corrections people, managers from the corrections department, and they're getting a little nervous and they're getting agitated. And one of them raised his hand, excuse me, Commissioner, yeah, this is going to have a huge effect on the jail population, tremendous effect on the jail population. Yeah. And well, we've been working very hard over the last few years to bring the jail population down. Bring it down. And he said, we just got to the point where we closed, and I think it was Flushing Avenue Jail, we closed a whole jail. Maple leans over the table, looks directly at the people from the correction department, and says, how quickly can you open it up? That was the crime turnaround. See, the crime turnaround isn't necessarily measured in the numbers of crimes, but the crime turnaround is something that happens in government. It wasn't a crime turnaround. It was a government turnaround. It was a way of thinking in government, at least as far as one-third of the government is concerned. Because those of you, you know, at least with good civics educations that go back as far as the third grade, know that the turnaround aspect of the government here was the executive. The executive turned things around. Unfortunately, there are two-thirds of the government, at least in my view, that have yet to join that turnaround. And let's talk about that for a minute. You've seen, those of you who read City Journal, I've talked about the courts. And I've talked about the New York courts time and again. There needs to be turnaround. There needs to be a different way of thinking. But it's not only limited to the state courts. It's the federal courts, too. And I haven't written about that yet. But just like the executive, this judicial branch needs to turn around. And where do we need to turn around in the federal area? Well, one thing that needs to be fixed, in my mind, to really change crime is Miranda. All right? In fact, the Fourth Circuit just wrote an opinion along those lines. But I think the Miranda rule really needs to be fixed. A recent study from the National Center for Policy Analysis found that up to 136,000 cases, violent crimes, go unsolved each year because of Miranda. Looking at 1995, they found that between 8,000 and 36,000 robberies went unsolved because of Miranda. And each year, okay, about 28,000 fewer convictions take place because of Miranda. Now, if this, or if Miranda's perversion of the Fifth Amendment isn't enough to make you think that things need to change, what about the Fourth Amendment? What about the need for the exclusionary rule reform? And Myra knows I can talk for a week on this one. Because the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule isn't in the Fourth Amendment. It was written in. It was written in for the entire country in Mapp versus Ohio in a case where the Fourth Amendment was never even argued before the court. That was an obscenity case. Sua sponte, the court decided, well, we're going to impose an exclusionary rule from C to C. And they did. That's activism. And then beyond that, we look at other cases that need reform. I look back to the 1980s when the case of New Jersey versus TLO, those of you in law enforcement, those of you attorneys, certainly those in education, may recognize that case. That's the case that lowers the standard for searches in schools. You know, you don't need probable cause, you need reasonable suspicion. And the liberals were just upset like you can't believe. Oh, we're washing away the standard. And the conservatives were saying, well, this might be good, a lower standard. I, in this case, went with the liberals, but for a very different reason. It was not good. New Jersey versus TLO was a bad decision. Because who needs to put the Fourth Amendment into schools? Why do we judge the actions of a school nurse by the same standards that we judge a police officer? If a school nurse, a school janitor finds something, should they be subject to the exclusionary rule? Made no sense to me. And it isn't only the old cases. Last week, if you read the Times, read any of the papers, Chicago versus Morales, an anti-gang loitering statute comes down. All right? And the court strikes it down as vague. Now, I don't know exactly that much about the statute. I read it. I really haven't decided, you know, whether or not the statute is good, whether it isn't good. But listen to the reasoning that they used to strike this down. It matters not whether the reason that a gang member and his father, for example, might loiter near Wrigley Field is to rob an unsuspecting fan or just get a glimpse of Sammy Sosa leaving the ballpark. A gangbanger and his dad. All right? Is that a Norman Rockwell piece of Americana for you? I mean, come on. I mean, I've been in the business for 18 years as a prosecutor. All right? I prosecuted everything from petty larceny to homicide. I prosecuted gang cases. And I've yet to see gangbangers involved with quality time with pop. It just doesn't happen. But they use that to strike down a statute. When if you look at the dissent, it's filled with real horror stories from people who said, you can't walk through my neighborhood. It's horrible. Fix it. Chicago did, but I guess it wasn't good enough. So the courts need to join in the turnaround. But there's another branch of government too, and I'll be quick here, our representatives, all right? And I always wonder why they call them our representatives, because if you look in New York, for instance, they can certainly never get anything done. They certainly, one house can't agree with another house, although they're supposed to represent us. And I look at them now, and I know that we're still waiting in New York for them to come down with a budget. They can pass a budget, but somehow these are the same people that manage to pay themselves. I don't know how this happens. On the other hand, what peeves me most in the criminal justice area is that for the last about 15 years, we're waiting for juvenile justice reform, and it just hasn't happened. Because it seems to me that especially the lower house is really waiting for what I call their own Jonesboro catalyst. In New York, for an example, if a 12-year-old commits murder, what is the absurd sentence? 18 months. 18 months for somebody who commits an intentional murder, a felony murder. That's the same sentence that a kid would get if he was in possession of a stolen credit card. It makes you wonder what the legislature thinks the value of victims' lives are. And what's even more bizarre is if that murderer happens to shoot somebody with a gun and put that gun into their room, into their home, the juvenile courts, the family court in New York, has no power to issue a search warrant. We have asked them time and again, give us the power for search warrants. Let us go after the guns. And the legislature simply says no. They give no reason. They supply no common sense. And they certainly supply no judgment, just a no. As long as the legislature continues to say no to meaningful reform, and as long as the courts promote the status quo, then there's really not going to be any turnaround, any real crime turnaround. But I want you to imagine that if one-third of the government, the executive, can bring about the results that we've seen, what would happen if the other two-thirds joined in? It's just a thought.